Hey everybody, nice to be here. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York and welcome, welcome, welcome. So tonight I'm going to talk about step 12 out of the AA 12 and 12. And the last time I had covered, there's actually three parts to this step. So I'm going to kind of quickly recap just what they are and then bring you up to speed where we left off. So there's three parts of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So the three parts. One is the spiritual awakening. You have to have had a spiritual awakening. Two, carry the message to other addicts. And three, practicing these principles in all our affairs. So the last time I spoke about the spiritual awakening, I shared about carrying the message to other addicts. And now the interesting part is in the AA 12 and 12, the majority of the focus is on the practicing these principles in all our affairs. And if you think about it this way, this is our purpose for having gotten recovered, is to practice whatever it is that you learned. These principles are not to be lived in only in the 12 steps rooms of recovery, but they're supposed to be in all of our affairs. We're supposed to take this that we learned because it's a new design for living and now go live it, right? Now go apply it to the rest of our lives. So we left off last time on page 114. I'm just going to go back a little bit. And on page 114, it says, our basic troubles are the same as everyone else. But when an honest effort is made to practice these principles in all our affairs, well-grounded AAs seem to have the ability, by God's grace, to take these troubles in stride and turn them into demonstrations of faith. So we all are going to experience life's difficulties, myself included. You know, issues with my kids, my mom, my job, you know, hello, the pandemic, right? We're all here. We've gone through that. Some of us still through it. And I would say that those difficulties were all things where if we are practicing these principles in all our affairs, our recovery doesn't just survive, but it actually thrives. It actually gets even more fine-tuned through life's difficult times. And the principles we learned in this program allow us to somehow go through all of these difficulties with optimism, serenity, faith, and purpose, right? So we get to go through these times with a positive demeanor. We're calm. We believe that God will take us to better things, or at least will carry us through. And we feel a sense of purpose. We've got important work to do in these rough times. And it really makes me think about one of the promises of a spiritual awakening, which is in the big book, in the chapter Working with Others, which is step 12 on page 100. It says, follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. You know, it's like we don't quite live in the same planet anymore with the same responses to hard circumstances. You know, I can somehow feel sad about a circumstance, but not be enveloped in despair, right? It's sort of like these circumstances are happening, but I've got this protective kind of thing around me where I'm not pulled into the vortex. You know, we take our big lumps as they come, it says, you know, but more difficult are sometimes the lesser problems. Those are like the pebbles in our shoes kind of problems. Those are actually more dangerous sometimes. We often, it says, we often discover a greater challenge in the lesser and more continuous problems of life. And what's our answer? Still more spiritual development. We get more spiritual development in the tough times, more spiritual development in the not so tough, annoying times. So even my seemingly minor problems have the potential to do a great deal of harm if I don't look at them and use them to grow. How often do we ignore an issue, right? For years, for me, I had two modes for years, the way I lived: denial or obsession. So I would ignore a problem, a minor problem, and let it compound, get bigger, get bigger, get bigger, until it got so big that I could not close my eyes to it. And then it was the only thing I could see and the only thing I could think about. I was obsessed with it. And generally what would happen is I would blow up. I would have a big blow up, and it wouldn't even make sense because it was such a small little thing, but it was piling up, piling up, piling up. And then of course I would feel guilty, right? And apologize for blowing up, but still never quite clean up what it was, right? So, what's the answer for people like me? Well, minor issues, I still take them through the 10 step, right? In fact, even more so. If I don't, then what happens is they attach themselves to other small issues and they grow into something huge and overwhelming, like little magnets, right? Just connecting to each other until they're really big and powerful. Page 114, now we're going to talk about some instincts. Talks about our instincts. Page 114. As we grow spiritually, we find that our old attitudes towards our instincts need to undergo drastic revisions. Our desires for emotional security and wealth, for personal prestige and power, for romance and for family satisfactions, all of these have to be tempered and redirected. I love that. Tempered and redirected. We have learned that the satisfaction of instincts cannot be the sole end aim of our lives. If we place instincts first, we've got the cart before the horse. We shall be pulled backwards into disillusions. But when we are willing to place spiritual growth first, then and only then do we have a real chance. So I want us to look at this idea of tempered, that we have to have our instincts, our desires tempered. What does it mean if it's tempered? Well, one, improved the elasticity by this heating and then cooling. And I think about that, that's sort of what happens to us. We undergo a lot of pressure, and then the steps kind of cool us back down. God kind of cools us back down. Two, improve the resiliency. If I'm tempered, I have improved resiliency. So my instincts cannot own me. We're often so incredibly concerned with our desires, right? Our emotional security, that ability to feel happy and steady and satisfied, monetary security, like having enough or even too much, wanting a lot, romantic security, right? Wanting like lots of love and lots of relationship, prestige and power, feeling really important. So if these are tempered, it means that I have to ride the storms of not having every one of my needs met, right? And not just when they're not met, but not exceeded at all times, right? And for me, I'll give the example of social needs, of this need to belong, which is a very human desire, but I need to have it tempered. Because for me, right, and for all of us, we all want to belong. That's actually part of a human protection. Human beings are social creatures, so we have a need to belong. My problem is I want to belong everywhere, even places where I don't have a need to belong. And someone one time explained to it to me like this. They said, well, yeah, human beings have a need to belong because that's how you survived. It gave you a warm spot next to the fire, extra food for your offsprings, right? A little piece of meat, a warm spot to sleep. My problem is as an addict, I have a spot by a fire, but I want a spot by everybody's fire. Right? I want a seat everywhere. I want to belong everywhere. And I need that tempered. I need that diminished for me. Page 115, after we come into AA, if we go on growing our attitudes and actions towards security, emotional security, and financial security commenced to change profoundly. We change the way we hunger for status, either the status of being with the right people or having money and possessions. It begins to diminish. Our demand for emotional security, for our own way, for having our own way, had constantly thrown us into unworkable relations with other people. We found that out in step three. This desire to have my own way all the time does not make for good relationships with people. Though we were sometimes quite unconscious of this, the result had always been the same. Either we had tried to play God and dominate those about us, or we had insisted on being over-dependent upon them. So, you know, it's common. We have this habit where we place unrealistic demands on people. I make their behavior, their successes, their affections, their attention, my God. It's what I begin to worship. If my very happiness and sense of security is riding on the backs of how others behave, then guess what? I'm now in bondage to them. So that is not the solution for me. I didn't get relieved of the bondage of food so that now I'm in bondage to other people. Bottom of the page says, we had refused to learn the very hard lesson that overdependence upon people is unsuccessful because all people are fallible and even the best of them will sometimes let us down. So people will absolutely let us down. If I spend my life dependent on people and I make their actions, thoughts, and affections my focus, what I say is I am shooting for a moving target because it will always be moving. So what's the solution, right? If I can't do that, what's my solution to be? Well, page 116 says, we would need to give constantly of ourselves without demands for repayment. And when we persistently did this, we gradually found that people were attracted to us as never before. And even if they failed us, we could be understanding and not too seriously affected. Because after all, we get tempered. So we're not so easily affected by other people. And to me, this is also what it means to be tolerant. That's the idea of being tolerant. I'm not so sensitive to the behaviors and attitudes of other people. So how is it that we're not so seriously affected? How does that happen to us that we are not as seriously as affected as we were before? Well, page 116 answers it, the middle of the page, because we rely on the best possible source of emotional stability, which is God himself, right? It's a relationship with God that actually allows us to have tolerance and temperance. If we really depended upon God, we couldn't very well play God to our fellows, nor would we feel the urge to wholly rely on human protection and care. These were the new attitudes that finally brought many of us inner strength and peace that could not be deeply shaken by the shortcomings of others or by any calamity not of our own making. So if I find myself overly upset by the actions, the attitudes, the behaviors of other people, what it really means is that I've moved away from my reliance on God, right? Step 12 also talks about, now we're gonna talk about marriages, because I guess that's part of the all of our affairs, right? Now we're gonna talk about marriages. And how many of us find that the steps fixes the damages and that our homes are happy? Because page 117 says, it's by eliminating the severe emotional twists that have so often stemmed from alcoholism. So let's be clear, not the alcohol, but the ism. The ism, right? Which is why, for me, just getting abstinent did not repair the damage in my family. It did not make me putting the food down did not just suddenly make me a better wife and mother. Mm-mm. Right? So the emotional nature is the ism. And our natures are severely emotional. But when we straighten out spiritually, we also straighten out emotionally. And then we become better partners. And let's be clear, this is not an overnight affair, right? Don't anybody think that the day you recover, all of a sudden, you're perfect in your home. But it's the work of our lifetime. It's the consistent reworking of our life. Page 118 cautions, we may become so wrapped up in AA or OA and our new friends in recovery that we are inconsiderately away from home more than when we drank or ate. And when we see them unhappy, we recommend, so then our family gets unhappy with us, right? Because we're not really paying attention to them. So what do? We start recommending the 12 steps to them, right? We start telling them, we start giving them the program line, right? The things that they should be doing to be aligned with our spiritual way of life. And we try to teach them how to live. And that's arrogant. It's arrogant. And it's certainly something I've been guilty of. Absolutely, I've been guilty of it. And we're reminded on page 119 that realizing what our partners have endured and now fully understanding how much we did to damage them and our children, we nearly always take up our marriage responsibilities with willingness to repair what we can and to accept what we can't. And it says, persistently trying all of AA 12 steps in the home, often with fine results. We commence to behave like a partner instead of like a bad boy or a bad child. And that's actually what begins to sell our families on why this work is good and why they should, give us some time to do this recovery work. Because what we begin to learn and grow and get from it, they should see the rewards. They should be reaping the rewards. And that we're not bad children. We stop behaving like bad children. And when I read that, I was like, ugh. Because when I look at honest, appraisal of sometimes my tantrum throwing, my pouty behavior, or outright refusal to do my fair share, it's clear that in recovery, I had a lot of growing up to do. For me, I've shared this before, it meant like mowing the lawn. It meant like doing some housework around here without a medal, without expecting accolades and a pat on the back, or announcing what I just did for people, right? How about instead of just announcing to my husband, I did your shirts, I washed your clothes, I hung your shirts up, like, just do it. Just do it. Page 119 also addresses the single people who look to have relationships with one another in the fellowship. And we're cautioned against love at first sight. We're told, like, be careful. And it says here, the perspective, this is on page 119, the prospective partners need to be solid in their recovery, solid AA, and long enough acquainted to know that their compatibility at spiritual, I love that it says spiritual compatibility, mental and emotional levels is a fact and not just wishful thinking. This also holds true for those who marry outside of AA. So I think some of us, we get so excited by meeting people, we're feeling good, that we fall in love with being in love, and that we don't necessarily see people for their true human characteristics, and that we want to make sure that in relationships that we're spiritually, connected, that there's a strong spiritual foundation first. So it's generally a practiced rule. It doesn't say it in the big book, but it is a common, kind of discussion that dating is discouraged until the fellow has worked through the steps and has some solid recovery under their belt and that they're clear and they're strong, right? And that to caution them that they don't make that other person their substitute higher power, right? Okay, page 120 talks about those that never marry and that they can be very happy and satisfied with their lives too. Can AA offer them satisfactions of similar worth and durability? Yes, whenever they try hard to seek them out. Surrounded by so many AA friends, these so-called loners tell us they no longer feel alone. In partnerships with other women and men, they can devote themselves to any number of ideas, people, and constructive acts. Free of marital responsibilities, they can participate in enterprises which would be denied to family men and women. We daily see such members render prodigies of service and receive great choice in return. And I have seen that. I know that there are people who I'm close with, who I love in this fellowship, who are not married, and they are able, and they do give tremendous service happily and have rich, full, tons of friends and strong, happy lives. And so what this tells me is that single or married, we have the same basic principle for a happy life. Work hard and seek opportunities to be useful wherever it is that you go. Okay, now we're gonna talk about money. This is another affair, right? Page 120 to 121. Money was the symbol of pleasure and self-importance. Page 121, upon entering AA, these attitudes were sharply reversed, often going much too far in the opposite direction. Financial importance was no longer our principal aim. We now clamored for material security. So what happens is people swing from spending like crazy to having major fears about money. If plagued with financial fears, we're forgetting four important things. One, our abilities, that we have God-given gifts and talents that we can now tap into, right? So when you're no longer owned and dominated by your substance, your gifts and talents can be tapped into, and they might be quite able to help you support yourself. Two, that we have a fellowship to help us find better jobs. It actually says that in there. We have a fellowship to help us find better jobs so long as we deserve the help. I know of many times where fellows offered one another interviewing assistance. I hear it of it all the time. Someone has like an excellent ability. They know a lot about the interview process and they'll practice with someone how to interview appropriately. Career counseling. I know people in the fellowship who will offer one another career ideas and counseling and even opportunities for employment. I know of people who have offered other people employment, right? Provided the people deserve it, provided that they're working hard. Three, if we're plagued with financial fears, here's another thing that we're forgetting. Everyone has struggles. And we forget that the actual or potential financial insecurity of every human being in the world. It's a common attribute. It's a common problem that many people face in their lives. It's not just something that the, you know, poor me is experiencing. It's a pretty, you know, across the board. And four, worst of all, if we're plagued with financial fears, we're forgetting God. In money matters, we had faith only in ourselves and not too much of that. The soul meant, of course, that we were still far off balance. When it looked like a mere means of getting money rather than an opportunity for service, when the acquisition of money, when the acquisition of money for financial independence looked more important than right dependence upon God, we were still the victim of unreasonable fears. In these fears, which would make a serene and useful existence at any financial level quite impossible. So if we begin to worship money ahead of God, we cannot be happy. We cannot be serene, and we cannot be happy. The 12 steps can promise us acceptance of our financial situations. We don't feel like we have anything big to prove. Page 122 says, it did not matter too much what our material condition was, but it did matter what our spiritual condition was. Money gradually became our servant and not our master. I love that. So that money is just able to help, right? It's actually what provides for me, but I don't provide for the almighty dollar. I'm not chasing that. It's not my master. And we found that freedom from fear was more important than freedom from want. So I would rather be free of being afraid and still like have things that I'm not getting than be consumed with what I need, my stuff, and be riddled with fear, right? We're freer when we live free of fear than when we live free of some of those luxuries. Better to do without the luxury and live with less fear. Another problem we're cautioned against is our feelings of self-importance. Page 123 talks about doctors who studied the personality traits of addicts. Yikes. And they found, here we go, that this is on page 123, most of the alcoholics under investigation were still childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose. Yikes. I don't know, I read that and I'm like, ow. Because we want more than our fair share of attention. Yep, check. Fame, money, and leadership. We're overly sensitive. Our feelings are hurt easily and believe that we are meant to be somebody. That's like a common feeling. You know, Bill talked about that in his story, that he can, you know, he fancied himself a leader. Right? He was going to be a great leader. He comes home from war with a medal, and now he's going to be the head of all sorts of wonderful enterprises. You know, they say actually that most kids at some point, all kids believe that they could be a famous athlete. Most little boys, you know, and little girls grow up and they think that they're going to be a famous athlete, a movie star, wealthy beyond all measure, you know, be the most beautiful thing in the world, even walk around thinking that they're going to be the president, right? And the addict doesn't just merely believe in the possibility, but they actually feel entitled to such extravagant achievements. They feel like it's their right to have all that. Yeah, I get it. I mean, I definitely have felt that way. Like, I'm entitled to be a superstar. Whatever that means, wherever I go, you know, in my family, I felt that, like amongst my siblings, I felt that, wanting to be like the favorite, wanting like all that stuff. I had felt it at work. I liked very much being like a star, but part of my recovery meant, yeah, that was I cannot worship that. That is not, I want to grow up. I don't want to be that little child who thinks that I'm entitled to those things. It says here, we simply had to be number one people to cover up our deep lying inferiorities. So it really comes from a place where we really don't feel very good about ourselves. And that's been like the fuel that we've used to make ourselves feel better about our inferiorities. So what happens for us? The steps make us right-sized. We get our feelings of self-esteem, not by having big accolades, but by esteemable acts, by acts of service, being useful and being of service without a badge or medal. Those are the things that actually make us feel more, you know, right-sized. We don't feel quite as inferior. when we're being useful and helpful to other people. Because really what it is that we're living in agreement with our purpose, with exactly what God assigned us to do and be. Page 124, it says, still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. And I have to say, like in the workplace, I found this to be really true, that I don't have to be the favorite, but I have to do a good job. And I actually found out that the idea of being the favorite was really because I have a little lazy streak and or like a little bit of an entitlement streak, a little bit of inferiority and superiority. So I wanted to be the superstar because there was grunge work I didn't want to do. That's the truth. You know, things like having to have my plan book in on time was like beneath me, right? And if you're the superstar, you kind of get away with other things. You know, I don't want to do like lunch duty. You know, if you're busy doing like super things for your boss, you're not stuck doing like wiping down the cafeteria table, right? And actually what I found out is that, in order to feel profoundly happy, I don't need to be a superstar. I actually need to do what God would have me do, to show up, to actually just show up. And what I found, you know, recently is one of the things that makes me feel really right-sized and good and productive is I take my lunch in the classroom with the kids just to be in connection with them. I'm not getting paid. But it's a way for me to get to be with them, to know them, to have a different presence with them, a different relationship with them. And I feel like it's very much aligned with what God would have me do and be. And there's no superstar status for that. There's no like, nobody cares, by the way, nobody cares in my workplace. And I can't even announce it. I can't walk around telling people that you're having lunch with the kids, doesn't matter. But I know it. I know it, and it's what feels right. And so not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service, gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. Yeah. So you don't need to be a superstar because everybody's important in God's eyes. The proof that we love, that love freely given, surely brings a full return. So doing things without a transactional attitude, without any thought of getting it back, the certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons, the surety that we no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. So actually just fitting in comfortably, like one of many, with other people, not above, not below, but shoulder to shoulder, right side by side. It says like we walk day by day together in the path of spiritual growth. Like that's actually where we get our deep satisfaction from. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God, right? So My ambitions today are different. And I love that, the 12 steps, this idea of practicing these principles in all our affairs really tells me that now, yes, I'm living in the world of the spirit, but I'm human, right? And I am supposed to be not living in isolation. You know, when you're thinking you have to be above people, you don't feel connected. And when you feel below people, you don't feel connected. And connection, I think, is the gift that God gives us. God wants us to feel in community with those around us. That's what it says here, that ambition is the deep desire to live usefully. Well, usefully with whom? With other people, right? And have humility and grace of God. And I'm going to end early. Thanks. I'll pass.